Well, good morning, all. Hey, glad to have you here today. I'm just glad to be here today. And we had a little cool weather. It's March, isn't it? Somebody told me one time that the heaviest snows in Oklahoma occur in March. Just something to think about. It is a customized world out there, isn't it? I mean, we've got a tremendous number of choices in our world, and we like it that way. We think we ought to have lots of choices. I don't know if you've ever gone to Crest Foods in Midwest City, but if you go to Crest Foods, you just go down the salad dressing aisle, and it looks like it just stretches on to the horizon. They've got more kinds of salad dressing alone. Did you ever just think about the number of types of ranch salad dressing you can get? You got your regular ranch, you got your buttermilk ranch, you got your bacon ranch, you got your low-fat ranch, your half-salt ranch, and it goes on and on and on and on and on. There are all these choices that we have, and that's the way we like it. Choice is king. That's the American way. Our country was founded on choice. We select our government, don't we? I mean, we elect these guys. We choose the leaders we want, and we send them to Washington so we can gripe about them for the next 4 years. And we do that regularly, but we make the choices. That's the way it ought to be. We think that that's just proper. When we buy a car, and then we put all these different options on it. You have all the amazing... I didn't realize this until just recently. You folks did, I'm sure, because you're smarter than me. Did you know that you can double the price of a car just with the options? You can go in and buy a $20,000 car, and then you start adding things to it, the options that you want. Get a different engine, get a different transmission, get a different color, different interior, DVD player, that wonderful expensive stereo, and before you know it, that $20,000 car is $40,000. You can have amazing options, but that's the way we like it, and we think that that's right. We custom build our cars. We custom build our computers. Did you ever think about the bottled water options? It's water, folks. It's water. But you can get all the different water. You can go down to Walmart and get Sam's water. You can get Aquafina water. You can get Perrier if you're feeling snooty today. You can get any kind of water you want. You could buy plain old Ozarka water. But we've got all these choices for water and everything else in life, and we think that's the way it's supposed to be. We have pretty much adopted the attitude in our lives that we ought to get whatever we want. After all, we've got individual tastes in our food. We've got individual tastes in clothing. We've got individual tastes in our hobbies. That's the American way. It seems, that's just a reflection of our wealth. Did you know wealth is about choices? Did you know that? The poor guy doesn't have a choice about what he's going to eat today. He eats whatever he has. Rich people choose what they want. Rich people choose which shirt they'll put on this morning. Poor people don't have that choice. Choices is a reflection of wealth. And since we have tremendous wealth in America, we think we ought to have lots of choices, choices for our cars and computers and hobbies, and it only makes sense that we ought to choose the church of our choice, too. And we just ought to attend the church that we like. We ought to have the kind of church we want with all the options that we like, and we ought to just have it the way we want it. It only makes sense. And in fact, to deny somebody choice, to deny a choice, is the most tyrannical thing you can suggest in our world. How dare you suggest that I have no choice whatsoever? That's a terrible idea that we should have no choices available. And that's why a lot of people will just bristle when you say, "Did you know that there's only one church?" There's not a lot of different churches. There's one. It's the one that belongs to Jesus Christ. That's all there is just one church. And that's the way the Scriptures talk about the church. When you scan across the New Testament Scriptures and you think about all those passages that talk about the church, sometimes the church is called the body of Christ, just like the reading that Dylan gave us this morning. Sometimes the church is called the body of Christ. Sometimes it's called the kingdom of God. Sometimes it's called a spiritual building. But in 1 Timothy chapter 3, verses 14 to 16, it's called God's household and the pillar and foundation of the truth. I want you to go with me to 1 Timothy chapter 3. That's where we're going to spend all of our time, just this little bitty section here. In 1 Timothy chapter 3, look at verses 14 through 16 together, and just have a few observations to make about the church. In 1 Timothy chapter 3, Paul has written to Timothy. He's been talking to him about leadership matters within the church. He's talked to him about the function and qualifications of elders. He's talked to him about the function and qualifications of deacons. And all this is important. It's important that Timothy have this information in his hands so that he can take it. And here's why. Let's start in verse 14, 1 Timothy chapter 3, read down through verse 16. Paul writes and says, "Although I hope to come to you soon, I'm writing you these instructions so that if I am delayed, you will know how people ought to conduct themselves in God's household, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and foundation of the truth. Beyond all question, the mystery of godliness is great. He appeared in a body, was vindicated by the Spirit, was seen by angels, was preached among the nations, was believed on in the world, was taken up in glory. There is only one household of God." That's what he talked about in verse 15. "If I'm delayed, you'll know how people ought to conduct themselves in God's household, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and foundation of the truth." Well, what does that have to say to us? If, you know, there's one household of God. What that means is, first of all, God is the one who has authority. He has authority in His church. The church wears, for example, His name. It really shouldn't wear the name of some human being or some organizational pattern or some doctrinal specification. It should wear the name of the Lord. That's just fair and reasonable. And what's interesting to me about it, especially from my perspective, my studies, so many people throughout church history have said the church ought to wear just the name of Christ. It should not wear some other name. Martin Luther, one of the great Protestant reformers, Martin Luther said, "Don't call yourselves Lutherans. Call yourselves Christians. We only want to be Christians. You don't want to follow me." And yet there are people who persistently choose to be called by his name. The church wears the name of the Lord because he's the one with authority and he's the one who determines the membership in his family. A household is a family. It's not a building. It's a family. And he's the one who determines membership in the family. How would you like it if the guy across the street comes over and knocks on your door and he says, "Congratulations, I've decided that I'm part of your family now. I went down here to the Department of Motor Vehicles and I transferred my driver's license, changed my last name on my driver's license, so it's the same as your last name, and I'm going to move in with you because I'm now part of your family. And by the way, can I borrow the car? And what's for dinner?" Wait a minute. You can't just do that. You can't just decide you're a part of the family. God determines membership in His family. He's the one who determines who's in. And he's given us some pretty good guidelines. He also, by the way, determines the teaching in his family. You know, all families have what the psychologists call family messages. It's really just a body of teaching that comes down from generation to generation. And you see that families typically do pretty much the same thing. You see families with traits that are handed down from generation to generation. That's the family messages. It's the way people live, the way people act. God determines the teaching in his family. He determines what we will know and what we shall do, the lives that we lead, because He has authority. It is, in fact, His church. And not only that, He has standards. He has standards. He cares about our behavior. "If I'm delayed, you will know how people ought to conduct themselves." Uh-oh. You mean I'm going to have to do things differently? Yes, sir. You're going to have to do some things differently. You're going to have a different way of life. God cares about our behavior. This is kind of a startling thought in the ancient world, because in the ancient world, they thought the pagans assumed that the pagan gods really didn't care what you did. You just had to perform the sacrifices and rituals at the right time, and then it was hands off. He really didn't care what you did beyond that. But when people told the gospel of Jesus, they said, God really does care what you do. And that was kind of a brand new idea for them. You mean my day-to-day behavior? It's really important. God cares about your behavior. He also cares about your worship. When you come to God in worship, you don't make this stuff up for yourself. You do what He says to do in worship. Which is why we do the things we do in worship. We gather together to worship God. We try to render submission and honor and glory to Him. So we take Lord's Supper on the first day of the week. We don't do that on Thursdays and Tuesdays and Wednesdays. We do it on the first day of the week like they did in the early church. We don't make this stuff up. We turn to Him for guidance on how we should worship because He cares about how we worship. You see, God requires us to submit to His culture. It's not the other way around. He does not submit to our culture. We submit to His culture. I was listening to a guy talk about this very point one time. He said, a guy came to him and said, you know, the church needs to be more relevant. He says, what do you mean by that? Well, you need to be more relevant. You need to talk about the issues that are important in our world. You need to engage with our culture. And the guy looked at him and he said, why would I want to do that? Your culture has brought war and pestilence and disease and pornography and, you know, all manner of bad stuff in the world. I don't want to engage your culture. I want to destroy your culture. The Lord wants your culture destroyed. Because your culture has brought all kinds of terrible things into the world. God's culture, on the other hand, is perfect. I think He's got hold of something there. And we need to submit to God's culture. He doesn't submit to our culture. He has authority in His church. He has standards in His church. And by the way, God is not splintered in this either. There are not many bodies of Christ. There are not many kingdoms of God. There are not many households of God. There's one. And that's what makes people get so upset about, because what do you mean there's just one? We should have lots of choices. But the Lord only established one church, and the whole concept of unity is really, really important. And that's why when Paul wrote to the Ephesians, one of the things he said in Ephesians chapter 4, he says, there is one body. Count them. Body. One. One body and one Spirit, just as you were called to one hope when you were called. One Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is over all and through all and in all. One is really important to God because God is one. And His body is not splintered. He established one church. One of the most basic ideas we can get is it is His church and not ours. It's not our church. And His church, by the way, has one truth to support. That's what Paul was saying to Timothy. In 1 Timothy chapter 3, he says, if I'm delayed, you will know how people ought to conduct themselves in God's household, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and foundation of the truth. He goes on to say, beyond all question, the mystery of godliness is great. He appeared in a body, was vindicated by the Spirit, was seen by angels, was preached among the nations, was believed on in the world, was taken up in glory. This word foundation that Paul uses here, that's a legitimate translation, but that's not the normal word that would be used for foundation, that thing under a building that holds it up. This could also be translated bulwark, and I think there are some versions that translate it bulwark of the truth. It's the place where truth is preserved and cared for, and you can always find truth established in this place, in the church. And that's the meaning that Paul has here. Not that the church determines what is truth, but this is the place where the truth is always held. The truth is always safe here. The truth that we have, the one truth, is the story of Jesus. That's what verse 16 is. Did you catch that? Verse 16 is the story of Jesus. The New International Version puts this in poetic form, and it is a poem. But I think it really goes in two stanzas of three lines each instead of three stanzas of two lines each. Because if you look at what the poem says, it says, He appeared in a body, was vindicated by the Spirit, was seen by angels. And that's basically the gospel story. He appeared in a body. He came into the world being found in fashion as a man, Paul said in Philippians 2, where he does another poem. Jesus took on a flesh body. Like ours. And then it says he was vindicated by the Spirit. I believe he's talking about the resurrection from the dead. Jesus' body is raised from the dead, vindicated by the Spirit of God. And then he's seen by angels. After that resurrection, Jesus appeared. He appeared to the angels, appeared to people as well. But that's the gospel story. He died, was buried, and raised from the dead. He appeared in a body. He was vindicated by the Spirit. He was seen by angels. But what happens next? What's the rest of the story? Well, that's the second stanza of three verses. He says he was preached among the nations, was believed on in the world, was taken up in glory. The gospel message went out to everyone, and people believed Jesus, and they obeyed the gospel because the message went out, and Jesus himself is established at the right hand of God and is coming again to receive his own. So you have, first of all, the gospel message, and then you also have what happens next, that the message goes out into the world, and that's the truth that we support. That's the truth that we teach and hold so dear in the church. Nobody else is going to do that. Nobody else holds that truth. You're not going to hear that truth propagated out here in the media. It comes from the church. And the church has to defend that truth. Okay. Time for our weekly poll. No, not that one. The other one. How many of you have heard something about the bones of Jesus having been discovered? There's a big documentary coming on. Okay, all right. Okay. Just makes me tired all over. I got a phone call this past week, and some other people have asked me, what about the Jesus bones? We got the ossuaries, these bone boxes that were found, say, Jesus, and another one says Mary, and then they've got a son named Joshua who's stuck all in there. And what about all that? Well, here's the thing all about that. First of all, every year, just before Easter, we are treated to these kinds of idiotic exposés. It is no coincidence that this story just now surfaces and this documentary is made by James Cameron, the director of Titanic. I guess that eminently qualifies him to be an archaeologist and a biblical scholar. He made a movie about a sunken ship. Okay, every year we get these shocking exposés. Last year, it was the Gospel of Judas. I was reminded of that in the newspaper this past week. It was the Gospel of Judas. Y'all remember that? The Gospel of Judas. Year before that, I think it was the Cave of John the Baptist, all designed to shake our faith and make us realize that what it says in the New Testament really isn't true. And the thing that I find so interesting about this current story about the Jesus bones, this story is so crackpotty that even the media can't report it with a straight face. They are not our friends, but they cannot resist. I mean, it is so nutty that even they have to say there is not an archaeologist in the world who supports this conclusion. And there is not a biblical studies scholar or historian anywhere who thinks that this might be real. But James Cameron's going to make some money putting that on TV. We need to be ready to give answer for things like that, because these nutty things will continue to pop up. And it's the church that is the bulwark of the truth. We need to hold carefully the truth of the Scriptures. We need to be ready to give answer for these things. And again, you know, that's something that the world will find pretty intolerable. What do you mean, one truth? I should be able to pick out the truth I like and stick with that one. If it's true for me, that should be good enough, right? Well, no, because truth is just truth. It just exists. That's the way it is. And the church has to support the whole truth. We don't get to support part of the truth. We don't get to choose the truth we like and reject the truth that we don't like. In a very startling and unusual incident this past week, I had a guy come into my office. He is a preacher for a denominational group, not even in this county. He was passing through town on another errand and popped in for something else, and he started talking to me about this. And in the course of the conversation, he let me know that he holds on to some of the Old Testament and rejects part of the Old Testament, and he holds on to some of the New Testament and rejects part of the New Testament. And I thought, now he didn't say it in those words, but that's what he admitted to me in this conversation. And I thought, how can you do that? How can you just hold on to the truth that you like, that seems convenient to you, and set aside the rest of it? How can you do that with any kind of intellectual honesty at all? And then you claim to teach and preach to others that they can do the same thing. No, look, folks, the truth is the truth, and it's the church's responsibility to embrace the whole truth. If Jesus is Lord, Lord means boss. It means He has the authority. If Jesus is Lord, He's Lord. May be unpopular in the world, but there's just one gospel. There's just one gospel of Jesus Christ. Okay, this is what Paul has written to Timothy, and by the way, to us as well. There's one household of God. It has one truth to support. But you know, the big question always is, what does it mean to me? What does this have to do with my life? Well, number one thing, of course, is since there's just one church, we got to make sure we're in it. There's just the one church. We have to conform to His will. It's not the other way around. We don't decide how we will choose to be His people. We don't make this up. We don't choose which parts of the Scriptures we'll obey and which ones we'll set aside. We have one covenant, one new covenant in Christ's blood. And we must make sure that we are in the Lord's church. There is only one. And it also means that we have to be absolutely firm in the truth. We're under constant pressure to modify our views, aren't we? To modify our views. We have certain views based on what we read and study in the Scriptures. We see that we're participating in the Lord's Supper every first day of the week. But we're under pressure always to modify our views. Interestingly enough, those who want us to modify our views are never interested in modifying their own views. They only want us to modify our views. We need to modify our views. Just modify. Look, I'm willing to be reasonable, and I think everything is up for study. I'll study any religious subject anybody wants to study. I'll do it, because we're on a search for truth. But look, G.K. Chesterton, a Catholic writer, by the way, had a brilliant statement when he said, "The point of having an open mind, like having an open mouth, is to close it on something solid." I think he's exactly right. When we find truth that is true, keep it. Keep it. If it's true, we don't have to modify it. Proverbs 23:23 is the passage that says, "Buy the truth and do not sell it." Do what you have to do to get it, but once you've got it, don't let it go. Buy the truth and do not sell it. We need to be firm in the truth. We need to be firm in the truth. And ultimately, of course, we must submit to Christ. This is our responsibility, to submit to Jesus Christ. We need to worship according to His will. We need to serve Him according to His will. We need to teach according to His will. It is His church and not ours. Again and again and again, I'll say it. We don't make this stuff up. We go to the Scriptures and we look to see what Jesus wants in His church, and we do that. We don't make this stuff up. It's His church. He's not going to customize the church to suit our tastes. You know, if you go down here to the Subway store, they got 6 different kinds of bread you can have a sandwich on. And they got 6 different kinds of soft drinks, too, in the little dispenser over there. That means you got 36 different choices just for bread and the soft drink. We hadn't even started with the meat and the cheese and the lettuce and tomato. And isn't it mean of me to start talking about food just before lunch? Sorry. But you know, we've got all these options in our lives. And we think it's right. You ought to be able to go in and get your Subway sandwich customized just the way you want it. All I would say about that is, that's great at Subway. Don't expect customer-driven options at the Lord's Supper. It's bread and fruit of the vine. That's it. Because it's not about us. It's about Him. God doesn't want 187 channels of entertainment from us. He wants us to sing praises to Him, making melody with our hearts. Bottom line here, Connie's been working on a project for me because she is such a great, fast typist. I'm a lot slower and more prone to mistakes. And she's been working through some of my old sermons from like 20 years ago. And she said, one thing she noticed is, my preaching style has changed a lot over 20 years. I said, really? No kidding. What's different about it? She says, well, you're a lot more diplomatic now. I said, yeah, okay. Well, that's, and you know, there's a place for that. I mean, you don't necessarily want to run out and just offend people. She said, you used to be a lot more blunt. Okay. I think there's a place for that too. And I know that sometimes I can be so diplomatic that people walk away going, I have no idea what that was about. I don't know what he was talking about. Here's the bottom line, folks. Don't bother attending the church of your choice. You attend the church of his choice. That's what it all comes down to. There's no such thing as a church of our choice. There's just the church. And it's his church. You just need to allow him to add you to the church of his choice. I'm not drawing lines saying who's in, who's out, anything like that. All I'm saying is it is Christ's church. It is not ours. And we must submit to him because he will not obey us. It's our responsibility to submit to him. 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 14. Although I hope to come to you soon, I'm writing you these instructions so that if I am delayed, you will know how people ought to conduct themselves in God's household, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and foundation of the truth. That church is the church that belongs to God. And that's the church we want to be a part of. By submitting ourselves to Jesus Christ. If you're not a Christian this morning, we're going to give you an opportunity to give yourself to Jesus. All you do is the same thing that everyone this side of the cross has done. You can read it for yourself. Look in the Scriptures and see, how did people become Christians? Well, let's see. They believed that Jesus was the Son of God. Faith is extremely important. Because of their faith, they confessed His name before men. They repented of sin, stopped doing the wrong thing, started doing the right thing in its place. They were immersed in water for the forgiveness of their sins and raised them to walk in newness of life. Imitate Jesus' death, His burial, His resurrection from the dead, so that His blood would cleanse them of sin. And from that day on, they walked with the Lord faithfully, doing His will, because it's His church, not ours. If you're not a Christian, we're going to sing an invitation song, give you an opportunity to do that very thing. If you're a Christian, though, you've made the covenant with Christ in the past. You did all that, but you really haven't lived with Him, haven't lived for Him, haven't been a bulwark of the truth. You need to repent and come back to Him and really submit yourself to Him. It's His church. We need to be His people. If you need to respond publicly, we urge you to do it right now.